Hello and welcome to QSO. I'm Ted Randall, and I want to say thank you for tuning in. Once again, our co-host today is Frank Howell, K4FMH, and our special guest today is author Don Keith, N4KC. Now, we want you to not touch the dial. Keep it tuned right here. If you've never heard Don Keith on the air before, tell the story of the novels and his ham radio background, his radio broadcast background, and so many other things. This is going to be a real treat for you. So keep it right here on QSO. With us tonight is our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH. And we want to say hello, Frank. How are you this evening?
You know, Ted, I am probably better than last week, and that's hard to imagine. I was all over the place, toe-tapping with that music you let us in with. You brought us in mellow tonight. I love it.
And with us is our special guest, Don Keith. And his call sign is K4KC. Now, a lot of you folks... Uh-oh, somebody's phone is ringing there. What are we going to do?
I thought I turned it down. I guess I didn't.
And that's November 4, Ted.
November 4.
Yeah, November 4. Hello, Charlie.
Okay. Think of it as we don't talk to each other on the air, just like Frank and I don't talk to each other on the air. So it kind of leaves us at a loss when we start referring to each other's call signs. You got to talk on the air to people before you start memorizing call signs. You know? A lot of you folks are probably familiar with Don Keith. You've probably seen him at the Ham Fest. And he's an author, and he's written a number of books. And... we're just hoping you've read some of those books and have him also have a chance tonight to tell us a little bit more about some of the new stuff he's written and the direction he's going in. And I think, if I'm not right here, I think, Frank, you guys have talked a little bit. I'm gonna turn it over to you and let you bring...
You bet. Now, when you say he's written a few books, you're used to big numbers, I guess, Ted, because he's written at least 30.
There you go.
I just finished the galley proofs for my latest book, which is on my trek to cure insomnia, Don. I know that there have been a few authors out there who've really gone before me and have really probably cured insomnia, because if you read some of their books, you know, your insomnia is cured. I just finished another one like that in the academic realm. But, wow, in awe of your productivity. And
well, I appreciate
we're
gonna
focus
that.
We're going to focus on some of your amateur radio. You've been on the QSO radio show before, and many of us know you through Hamfest and through amateur radio. What many folks listening tonight may not realize is your tremendous background in commercial broadcast radio. Why don't we amplify your bio briefly? Tell us a little about your career, particularly in the Birmingham area, in commercial radio.
Well, that's one of the beautiful things about ham radio is it's such a natural lead-in to careers in technical fields, non-technical fields, and I talk about that in the books as well. But I became a licensed amateur radio operator at the age of 13, never knowing that it would turn into a career in broadcasting. But when I went to the University of Alabama, I actually intended to be an attorney. So I was going to go on and go to law school when I finished there. But when I first showed up on campus, I went to the on-campus student-run radio station and fell in love with the whole concept of being I'd always wanted kind of to be a disc jockey anyway. But I also visited the television production studio for the Educational Television Network there, and I got a job there because I had been a ham radio operator. They said, if you're a licensed ham, you probably can run a camera and you can run audio, the audio board, and you can light a set and that sort of thing. And I said, of course I can. I had no idea if I could or not, but fortunately they hired me and gave me a chance. Well, that led to a 22-year career in broadcasting, doing about everything you can do in radio, on the air, programming, managing a station or stations, owning stations, running groups of stations, and that sort of thing. I did that for a long time. Then I worked for a company that developed software for broadcasters and ad agencies. And eventually we were purchased by the Arbitron Company, which some may recognize as being the company that measures radio audiences. And then did that for a long time and ended up with 10 years running an advertising agency. All that because of ham radio.
Ham radio is such a portal. For one thing, it probably gave you the confidence to say, I can do that.
Absolutely.
When you hadn't, perhaps. Your software, what was that software, what was the focus of the software that you talked about?
Well, when that software was originally developed, most commercial broadcast stations did not even have a computer in the station. They were doing the programming logs, the commercial logs, all that sort of thing, by hand or with a typewriter. But a fellow here in the Birmingham, Alabama area had the idea. He was sort of a computer geek, but he was also a midday disc jockey and program director on a station. He came up with the idea of using a very early Radio Shack computer and writing a program in BASIC that would take the Arbitron ratings numbers and allow the station to break those out and produce a schedule and to produce a presentation that they could take out to potential advertisers and show them exactly how the station did in particular age groups and male, female, and that sort of thing.
All the demographics.
Exactly. And as time went on, they developed a similar program for television, which became the number one used software in TV stations all over the world. My particular product that I dealt with mostly scheduled music for radio stations. So you could plug in the songs that you were playing. You had them categorized, and you could make sure you played a hit song three times an hour, and you always followed it up with a well-known song, that sort of thing. You assigned the criteria and was able to schedule your music for the station so it sounded the best.
What was curious, what was the name of that software?
That software was called Music Scan.
Music Scan. Well, I'm not familiar with that. Now there's Music Master. Now there's Selector. And
Music
I don't
Master.
Know.
Music Master was the person who actually wrote that software. He took the product back and marketed it himself. Selector was my big competition.
And the thing about Selector is, it's extremely complicated. I mean, they've got more whistles and bells and switches on that thing. And then there's a fellow that came along. Have you ever heard of this fellow? I think his name is Larry Tishart or something like that. He
doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, he wrote a he's got both a thing called Natural Log and Natural Music, and it's kind of like a common sense rollout of what Selector and some of the others are supposed to be. The commercial versions now that do the commercial logs are just totally out of control. I mean, unbelievable. You know?
Do either of you recognize Pristine Systems?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yep. Well, you probably have heard of a guy named George Thomas, W5JDX, who's on the Ham Nation podcast, has Amateur Radio Logic. George co-owns Pristine Systems, and they do the automation software, as well. Don, back when I was in commercial broadcasting and helped start a couple of stations, I, like you, worked at a campus FM station, but I was the one that created that station. And in fact, it sort of signed on as I was leaving. I had then gone on to start an AM station. There were three heavy advertisers to a single station market in Georgia. And every New Year's Eve, they had a little ritual where they would each one make a have a thought, and they'd do their toast and throw their glasses into the fireplace. And as soon as they threw their glasses, each one would say the thought, and the highest vote wins. And so this one year, that was between growing a turnip patch and starting their own competitive radio station. And so the radio station won, and I was that boy over to the college who was doing that FM station, and so they got me involved. The only advice I got, Don, was when you come out of the news, boy, play a blank kicker, and I'll leave it to your imagination as to what the preface to the kicker was.
That's what Music Scan and That's what Music Scan and Selector did. They allowed you to make sure you always came out of the news or a commercial break with a big up-tempo hit song, a blank kicker, if you will. But it also kept you from playing the same
song. Ladies
and
gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be back with our special guest, Don Keith, N4KC, and our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH, right after this. For those of you that would like a shortwave radio that's bigger than maybe what you could hold in the palm of your hand, but yet is sensitive and selective, let me talk to you about the CC Radio Shortwave. The purpose of the CC Radio Shortwave was born when an engineer's time went into producing some of the best reception and audio that you could find in a portable radio. It's got all the necessary things, the tweakings available for excellent performance under various conditions, and offers the best combination of sensitivity, selectivity, and audio performance of any radio its size. Now, this radio delivers some of the best FM reception, and thanks to the built-in twin-coil ferrite antenna, the AM antenna I'm talking about, it makes the AM on this radio absolutely exceptional. It has continuous coverage of the shortwave bands and excellent reception right off the whip antenna. The 5-inch speaker is accurate, pleasant, and probably produces deeper bass than any portable of the same size. The CC Radio Shortwave is one of the few radios with a mono switch. When activated, the radio filters out the stereo FM multiplex signal, which can add a hissing noise when you're listening to a weak station. Now, let me tell you, this thing has an RF gain control, bandwidth control, fast and slow tuning. It's got bass and treble controls. It's got a lighted LCD display and lighted buttons, clock radio, snooze alarm. It only weighs 4.2 pounds, even though it's a pretty good size radio. Has a stereo headphone jack, stereo line output, so you can plug it into a recorder of some sort. It's got an IF out for input into a computer, 50 memory presets, a built-in charger with auto shutoff for nickel cadmium batteries. It uses 4D batteries or 4 AA batteries, whichever you prefer, and all the programming backup, that is, for, you know, when you put in your memories and whatnot. You can order this radio from the Sea Crane Company. It's real simple to do. All you have to do is call Bob Crane at 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And mention WTWW when you order this radio. Now, that, once again, the phone number is 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL, call sign K4JSG. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom designed cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, You'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, Don Keith, N4KC, and our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH.
People are creatures of habit. You're in the car on the way to the work, typically at the same time every day. And if you hear the same songs every day, then you think that's all the songs the station plays.
Well, you know, it really depends on it depends on the station. That little station, and I'll get off of this. You know, someone had to work Sunday morning, and we only had one religious album. It was by the Blackwood Brothers. Well, my uncle was the head of a group in Columbia, South Carolina called the Singing Howells, and they had the Greyhound bus and the whole deal. And so he sent me an album, and so on Sunday mornings when I worked, we only had two albums to choose from until we convinced them.
You didn't need software.
Put a dollar or two. You got to put a dollar or two in some religious records here for Sunday morning in rural Georgia here. Well, you know, a lot of people don't know you have that background, Don. That's why I wanted to bring that out. What's been your sense, because you've been at every place in that process, all the way, you know, out into advertising, where you're then a customer of those stations. What's your take on from the Reagan era forward, how radio regulation has changed, where you can have the iHeart radios and the Clear Channels and the others, where you've really got a huge network across the country rather than a tremendous number of individual stations that may choose, pick and choose what they want to pick up from network?
You know, this is actually a subject Ted and I dealt with at length on a previous show. And it is also a subject that I dealt with in one of my books, a novel called Wizard of the Wind.
We're going to get there, sir. Going to get to that one. You bet.
Answer to your question, back in 1995, the Federal Communications Commission, which regulates amateur radio and commercial radio and telephones and a lot of other things in our daily lives, issued a new rulemaking where they greatly relaxed ownership rules and allowed owners to have more than an AM and an FM in a single market. When I started the business, and I suspect when both you fellows did too in commercial broadcasting, you could own an AM and an FM in a total of seven different markets, but only one of each in each market. Well, when that rulemaking came in the mid-90s, it allowed you to own far more stations in a single market. What that created were some super groups of broadcasters, Clear Channel, Cumulus, and CBS, and several of the others just became huge. When that happened, I was ecstatic. I thought, this is the greatest thing that has ever happened, because I had always worked for moms and pops, and they were a lot of fun to work for, and we kind of did things by the seat of our pants, and that included the technical aspect as well as the programming and commercial side. And I thought, now, with these big groups, they're going to come in, they're going to spend a lot of money, and they're going to buy us a bunch of great, shiny new equipment, and they're going to do a lot of promotion. They're going to really promote the stations. They're going to pay top dollar for talent. None of that happened. None of that happened. It went exactly the opposite way. A group would come into town, and they would buy every signal they possibly could buy until they had bought every station that they were allowed to own in a market, with no idea whatsoever how they were going to monetize those stations. How are they going to make money with all these marginal signals? A lot of them were moved in from faraway places, and just a very slight signal covering the market, just enough they could claim it was a station licensed to that market. And they would not spend money on promotion. They would not spend money on talent. What they had to do was cut every dollar they could cut to keep the stations on the air. And a lot of that meant no promotion. It meant voice tracking, hiring one announcer to do shows on 30 radio stations around the country, or bringing in syndicated talent, especially for the key day parts, which are morning and afternoon drive in radio. So it did not turn out the way I thought it did. I still think eventually it's going to go the other way. You're going to have more and more moms and pops that are going to pick up some of those marginal signals and then some of the stronger signals, and they're going to put good quality programming. They're going to have to. Look at what's happened. Technology is changing so rapidly. It affects society. It affects ham radio, and we could talk about that a little later on too. But it definitely has affected media.
Well, you know, when was the last time? Don, I was going to say the only thing that I look at is the fact that you have Clear Channel Radio changes their name to iHeart Radio. But right in the middle of that, the published figures show that they are in debt by $23 billion. Not million, billion. $23 billion is the debt that iHeart Radio is in. I don't understand how you operate a business that's $23 billion in debt, and I don't understand how you can trust management of an outfit like that with those kind of numbers. It seems to me that the thing that would scream really loud is, we're doing this wrong. This is not correct, you know? And then like you have a guy like Bill Drake, who sat back and watched all this happening, who was an expert at radio programming, and would just shake his head and say, you know, it's a kamikaze mission is what it is. You know, so I don't know. And I'll tell you, Cumulus is right in the same category. I don't have published numbers, but there was an article that just came out about them that would blow your mind if you read it. You know, and of course, we know the two Dickey brothers that just got ousted from their positions. So radio's
2 years
not
ago
in good shape. Go ahead.
2 years ago, their stock price was $4 a share. It's 72 cents a share the last time I looked. So it's like a lot of industries where you're running the whole company to please Wall Street analysts, not to please your customers.
Don,
I'm not saying iHeart or Cumulus or anybody else. I'm not blaming them necessarily, but that's the way the game is played.
Don, I'll echo that, and it was a shock to me. I sat on the Secretary of Agriculture's advisory board. We sort of governed the Census of Agriculture. We tried to change it from the Census of Aggravation to the Census of Agriculture for farmers. And I had an ag economist explain to me that the big agribusiness corporations in the last quarter of the year, or meeting any quarterly numbers, they would sell products to farmers and make zero profit on it. And they would sell it to them on time with zero interest like the car dealers do now. And they'd still make money. And I said, well, that doesn't make any sense. Says they were trying to meet the expectations of Wall Street, because by making nothing on their actual product, if they met the expectations, their stock prices went up, and therefore the stockholders made money.
Exactly.
And that was the point.
And how are most of the executives at a publicly held company paid anyway? It's in stock and stock options. So as long as you can keep the stock price up, then you're keeping those guys happy.
You have touched on what's clearly kind of a disruption of the radio industry. One of the things that we've heard, Don, and certainly Ted and I have chatted about this, we've heard this mantra for, I don't know, at least 5-6 years now. Shortwave radio is dead. It's dead. And you'll see government shortwave broadcasting from some of the major players withdraw their shortwave programs. But at the same time, we know there are manufacturers of shortwave radios making 30,000 of them a day. They're going somewhere. Someone's buying them. So in this prognostication that shortwave radio is dead and the dire straits that the commercial AM and FM broadcasters are in, I'd throw this out there that we often say something's dead, but it's really not dead. It's just changing. What are some of your thoughts? And Ted, you're certainly in the mix of this as well. What are some of your thoughts about, let's just assume that neither are dead, what are they changing into?
Exactly. And this has always been the case, and it always will be the case. Everything changes. Technology changes more rapidly now. I saw an article not long ago that said technology itself, technological knowledge doubles every 5 years. Medical knowledge doubles every 3 years. And, you know, when things double like that, they get real big real quick, or the change is very rapid. A lot of people can't accept that. The people who profit, the people who do well, are the ones that take advantage of that change. They see what's coming. When was the last time you picked up a newspaper and looked at the classified section? How big is the classified section in the Nashville, Tennessee? And the Nashville Banner doesn't exist anymore. In my hometown, the daily newspaper is now only published 3 days a week. When was the last time you saw a copy of Life or Look or the Saturday Evening Post or the Reader's Digest? Those things have gone because nobody took advantage of that change and sought a smart way to profit from it. I still think radio has a chance. Radio simply is providing content that attracts enough of an audience that will actually go out and purchase the products that are advertised on that station. Every radio audience has a value to some advertisers at some price. You've got to be able to put on content on a broadcast station that will attract a sizable enough audience of people who will respond to the advertising message and will go out and buy the sponsor's products. If you do that, you can do fine. Well, you don't have to be number one.
But here's the problem. You see, you have these people like the iHeart people who decided, and a lot of folks don't know what voice tracking is, but voice tracking is where an announcer goes in a little booth and sits down, and he plays the tail of the record, talks over it, plays the ramp of the next one, talks it up, goes to the next record, does the same thing, and in about maybe 25 minutes, you can actually voice track a four-hour show. And now, if all of the radio stations in this group are set up the same way with the same library, you can transfer those voice tracks to every market that you're in. And you got the same guy doing the same thing on every radio station across the country. And in their eyes, they're only having to pay one person.
Exactly. And you don't have to worry about vacations and 401ks and all somebody quitting and going across the street to the competition and taking his or her audience with them. You know, Wall Street hates risk, and having personalities or having people on your station that are really great, having the risk of them leaving or dying or going out of the business or whatever is too big a risk.
Well,
just pay some guy to talk plain and say the call letters nicely.
The problem with that, though, is that with no risk is no gain. And that's always
no
been
reward.
In radio. And the biggest risk takers in radio have always been the ones that showed the biggest profit margins in the end. Now, the other thing is this. The audience, I'm telling you, call it psychic, whatever, they can tell the difference between a live radio show and a voice-tracked radio show. How?
You know why?
I don't know. They can tell. And even, you know, as much as I have accomplished in doing voice tracking to make it sound so live to where my friends don't even know if I'm on the air, the overall audience does not respond in total in large numbers to a voice-tracked radio show like they do a live one. And how they can tell, I don't know. If you've got the answer to that, let's hear it now. I want to know what this is.
I tell you, I know why. Because the number one piece reason people come to radio or any other medium is not for news. It's not for entertainment. It's for companionship. They're looking for somebody who's experiencing the same thing they're experiencing at exactly the same time and in the same place that they're experiencing it. There's just something about talking about the local high school team that lost the big game last night, or just, you know, what a beautiful day it is for having the top down on the way to work this morning, or little things like that that can be dropped in that make you – the best disc jockeys, the best radio personalities are the ones that don't talk to an audience. They talk with an audience. And if you're voice tracking 30 radio stations, you're not talking with anybody, you're talking to. Radio's never going to win. Commercial radio is never going to win a music streaming battle because there are too many other places where people can hear music streamed, music being streamed at them with no commercials or practically no commercials on a myriad number of devices. Radio is not going to win that battle anymore. They're going to have to give people that companionship and that warmth that only a live personality who's experiencing the same time and the same thing in the same time and place as the audience is.
Don, one of the things that I want to let you know, you talked about your role in pretty much all aspects of broadcasting. You may not have had the experience that Ted had this week. Ted's a little under the weather because he spent, I think at least 2 to 3 days replacing charred insulation as part of an antenna circuit.
Oh, my goodness.
He sent some pictures to me, and with the bucket trucks and working at night and some things like that. And the closest thing I could come to it is when I showed up at the daytime station and somebody didn't change the paper on the teletype machine, which meant I got my pocket quarters and raced downtown and got every newspaper I could find to try to put a newscast together. But so Ted does, and his family, they have really had their battles this week. Did you ever do any of the technical side of the engineering side in broadcasting?
Well, I was a very poor backup engineer for a group of stations. We had one engineer that was at the beginning of let's cut everything we can cut and we'll cut our way to prosperity in broadcasting. We had one engineer who was based in Birmingham, and we had stations in Nashville and Knoxville and various places around the South. Well, I was the backup engineer, and I would have to hop in the car and go throw a breaker to get us back on the air or whatever. In one of the markets, the one that I actually started in here in Birmingham, we had an old water-cooled homebrew 50-kilowatt AM transmitter, and you really had to be more of a plumber to keep that thing on the air than you did an engineer. So, yeah, I've had my experiences with those sorts of things.
Well, Ted, what was it that you had to replace? I saw some of the pictures of it, and it looked like a lightning strike had hit something.
That was an insulator that was used to support the transmission line. And, of course, the voltages that develop across those things are absolutely horrendous. So when you're running... you know, you figure on that rhombic, you've got roughly 5 million watts ERP, you know, on that thing. I mean, it depends on at what point you are. But on the transmission line, if you're right on the voltage node, there's no telling how high that voltage is. I mean, it's through the roof. So this thing is about 1.5 feet, 2 feet long, and it was used to hold up the support part of the transmission line. And somehow it became conductive. Yeah, and there were great big gigantic holes all the way through it, which is more really indicative to RF failure over time than it is actually lightning. Lightning usually materializes in a different way on these insulators. And for the most part, we haven't really had a whole lot of lightning issues at all, which I'm surprised because we got miles and miles of wire out there. But, yeah, this was just a breakdown, and chances are that insulator probably had been giving us trouble for some time, and we were unable to figure out what it was. You go to tune, and all of a sudden you see an erratic spot or a little, you know, it's like a little arc going on somewhere, but you can't find it because you got miles of antenna line. I don't know. I hope that when it What's really exciting is when you start having things like fireballs on the line and stuff like that. That's when it really, that's when you you really get tested. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be back with our special guest, Don Keith, N4KC, and our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH, right after this. One of the new radio frontiers is Wi-Fi radios. You know, what's a Wi-Fi radio? Well, this is a radio that sits on your desk or wherever you happen to put it. It does not require your computer to listen to radio stations. It's self-contained. It picks up internet by means of Wi-Fi or by means of direct plug-in by Cat5. Once the internet is accessed, this radio has access to 16,000 organized stations, and there's no subscription fee. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the CC Wi-Fi radio. And, you know, fooling with a notebook or a desktop to listen to radio becomes a real pain. It's cumbersome. And the little CC Wi-Fi radio sits on your desk. It's small. It's just like a little radio sitting on your desk. And you program into it what you want to listen to, and it'll give it to you. Or you can surf the dial, get on there and just start surfing. You'll find things in every country of the world. Like I said, 16,000 organized stations to choose from. Now, this thing has great audio. It can be connected to your stereo system with RCAs, you know, on the back and whatnot. Now, you've got to see this. You've got to see this. You need to go to the C-Crane Company's website at ccrane.com. That's ccrane.com. Now, this thing's got Pandora on it, Live 365, MP3 tunes, has an alarm clock, actually has a Wi-Fi strength signal indicator, and line out for headphone and a headphone jack. So you have line out and a headphone jack. An Ethernet port on the back for instant and secure connection to the Internet 99. Memory presets and a remote control. You've got to see this radio. I don't care what kind of music you like. Jazz, classical, country, southern gospel, oldies, rock and roll, classic rock. It's all on. It's all on the CC Wi-Fi radio. And very easy to select and very, very easy to find. Now, all you have to do is go to ccrane.com. That's ccrane.com. Or better yet, go to WTWW's website and click on the C-Crane logo. That's right. Just click on that C-Crane logo. You've been to our website, WTWW.us. Click on that C-Crane logo and go in there and look and find the CC Wi-Fi radio. Actually, they have several models, so you want to look and see which one you'd like the best, okay? And if you don't have internet access, give them a call. 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And when you get on the phone, do mention WTWW, because Bob Crane's bringing you Art Bell's Midnight in the Desert, along with a lot of other programming you're listening to on WTWW. So they want to hear that from you. 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL, call sign K4JSG. the world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom designed cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, you'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, Don Keith, N4KC, and our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH.
Don, we're on shortwave, commercial shortwave right now, and I want to transition now into a topic that you have written on. When we think about shortwave listening over the past, I don't know, 25, 30, 40 years, you think of names like Harry Helms, Bob Groves, Larry Magny, who started Passport, and a lot of people I'm leaving out. And sort of the heyday of that was during the Cold War when people wanted to find out who was doing what and what was the next move and things like that. When Bob Groves retired and his very popular magazine, Monitoring Times, closed, and he allowed his writers to kind of carry on in that market with the Spectrum Monitor, things, it went digital. And a lot of people, like I said, it's a shakeout in shortwave broadcasting. Many of the governments have closed down, but my own opinion is that the commercial sector, it's a bright, bright future out there. If you're in China or you're in Africa, for example, and speaking as a Christian, it's a shame that if you're caught with the Bible, some bad things can happen to you, but if you're caught reading a Bible on the internet, if it's not suppressed, then there's a trace of that. But people generally don't know what you've been listening to on the shortwave radio. So shortwave is reaching some areas and for different reasons than it did before. You have a book, Riding the Shortwaves. I bought it. I've read it. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a book that introduces those who've had no experience and those who've had some experience and those who've been doing it all their lives to the joy of shortwave listening. And that's a mouthful. It includes ham radio. I think your point about the need to affiliate, that is, you want to have that person conversate with you. I think that's one of the reasons why many amateur radio operators listen to the mail or read the mail, and then other SWLs listen to hams, because it's like you're sitting in that old store with the pot-bellied stove and listening to people talk. Tell us a little bit about Riding the Shortwaves and what brought you to write that, and tell us a little bit about it.
Well, and you're exactly right. It's that companionship thing we were talking about with commercial over-the-air broadcasting in the U.S. and a lot of other places, too. I've been a ham for 55 years, which will tell you my age very quickly, since I told you I was 13 when I got my first license. And I've been in communications all my life. I've been a news person. I've won every AP and UPI award you can win. I'm the only person that's ever been a Billboard magazine personality of the year twice. I've been a writer for over 20 years. So I consider myself a pretty good communicator, but I was having a difficult time explaining to people about the magic of shortwave radio or the magic of amateur radio. Why should somebody get into this hobby, or why should somebody purchase and listen to a shortwave receiver when we have smartphones and computers and tablets and desktops and Wi-Fi and cable and satellite radio and all those sorts of things? And I decided I'm going to sit down and try to put this into words so I can explain to people exactly what it is that attracts not everybody. And our hobby, whether it's SWL or whether it's ham radio, it's not for everybody. And I recognize that. But I want to make sure that anybody who has any spark of interest whatsoever will realize why it's worth going to the trouble, in the case of ham radio, of getting a license and putting a station together and putting up an antenna and getting on the air, or if you're a shortwave listener, actually purchasing or building a radio or a kit, putting up an antenna and trying to snatch those signals out of the air. And it came down to, it's magic. The whole thing to me is still magic. I got started because my dad was the first television repairman in our part of the state. When he got out of the Army after World War II, somebody told him that this television thing was going to take off, and just like all electrical stuff, it was going to break, and somebody would have to fix it, and somebody was going to have to put up antennas and that sort of thing. So he had a good, strong technical background. But I remember waking up early in the morning, and I would hear him downstairs with his big old Zenith huge radio tuning in signals, not just from Dallas and Chicago and New York City and Atlanta and New Orleans, but he was pulling in signals from Havana, Cuba, Radio Havana. He could hear Radio Moscow on that old Zenith receiver. To me, that was absolute magic. And that's what I tried to convey in writing the shortwaves. The subtitle is Exploring the Magic of Amateur Radio. And if I could get that concept across to folks, then I think we'll attract a whole new generation to something that's just, it got conjured up by a wizard somewhere.
Did you know Harry Helms?
I did not.
For those who are listeners and those who don't know, Harry Helms was an author. He worked in publishing. He's passed on now. He had a form of cancer. And had the oh-so-typical period during the last phases of his life, and he wrote a blog at which I sort of tracked and kept up with him. He had a bent for those strange signals out there, things like number stations that we now know in our own OSS, which became the CIA founder, in his biography has said, oh, yeah, that's how we communicate with our assets out in the field. He would go out to Area 51 and sit and listen and try to keep up with those with those strange signals. Do you talk anything about some of the strange things? You know, the broadcasters, you kind of know what they are. But what about some of the strange things that we can hear on the shortwave? Does your book cover any of those things?
Talk about some strange folks in broadcasting. Whoa. we could tell some stories, couldn't we? In fact, I did. That's another book. I don't think people realize the full amount of things that can go on when you're bouncing signals or refracting signals off the ionosphere that's up there above us, or in ham radio where you can bounce a signal off the moon, or off the water tower on top of the hill in town, or off the northern lights, off the tail of a comet. And I've heard those signals. I've worked stations that were refracted off the junk that was in the tail of a comet. And it's strange sounding. I love to work. I've used a microphone to make a living for a lot of years, but I'm about 80% Morse code when I get on the air, and about 10% digital and only about 10% voice. But to hear the strange warble of those signals coming over the North Pole from Asiatic Russia is just absolutely amazing to me. And I may read an excerpt if we have time in a few minutes from my book, my novel, Set in Broadcasting, where I talk about you hear those good, strong signals on AM radio at night, and then that signal will disappear into the flotsam, and then it seems like it rides back in on a wave, and the signal is loud and clear again. I love that sound of those old AM broadcast stations from distant points that they fade up and fade down. That sort of stuff just fascinates me, and I think it would fascinate a lot of other people, too, if they got a chance to hear them.
I would contend that for particularly a neophyte ham or someone just interested, that learning the magic of propagation, it's magic because we don't fully understand it, and we probably will never fully understand it, but just regular old AM broadcast band DXing can teach you so much. That understanding the gray line, you know, whenever it's half hour before the sun setting to a half hour after, so many things kind of come in over the transom. A lot of stars you talked about, you know, of course, WLS in Chicago was one of the leading stations in the era of rock and roll. And my little modest dream was to do the voiceover for the one ID they did at midnight on Saturday nights, the only time that they used it. And I tried my best to send tapes, cassette tapes and things, but I was never chosen, was never sort of in that loop. So I hear you with what you're saying. It's amazing that we can listen to many military aircraft because many of them use HF. Some of it is hidden, but we got decoders and things like that. Let's do this. Go ahead and take that excerpt and tell us a little bit about what you've written on the broadcasting. Let's take time to hear your writing.
Well, this is a book called Wizard of the Wind, and I dedicated this novel to 328 radio disc jockeys. And these are the people that I consider to be wizards of the wind, because they're the ones who could get on the air and with two turntables and a microphone could create an entire show that would have people all over town involved in what was going on.
Now, this is a story about Jimmy Gill and his grandmother, Zenith.
Yep. Jimmy Gill was a young kid who fell in love with those distant signals. He decided he would go into broadcasting. He got into it very accidentally. And Jimmy became a metaphor for what's happened in the broadcasting business. He got into the business for all the right reasons, because he wanted to be heard. He wanted people to respond to what he was saying. He wanted to mix the music together and take the songs that were so popular during the 60s and 70s and put together a true show that would attract attention and have people involved in what he was doing. But he became corrupted by the money and the power and did a lot of things that hurt the medium of broadcasting before, well, almost losing everything, including his life. There's a ham radio operator who plays a big part in Wizard of the Wind. He's an engineer who was along with Jimmy for this wild ride and in the end saved Jimmy's life using his technical knowledge. But the one little segment here that I want to read is about Jimmy sitting in his broken-down little house in a bad neighborhood in Birmingham, Alabama. And he decides to turn on his grandmother's old Zenith radio because his grandmother's totally captivated by television. And remember, you guys remember a time when the prediction was television would be the death of radio. Well, radio reinvented itself, as it's going to have to do again, and became even more powerful than ever. But this is sort of Jimmy's experience. The night before had brought another batch of miraculous revelations from behind the Zenith's dial. Jimmy had stayed up later than usual, but he had spent only a few minutes in front of the television set with Grandmama. She never noticed when he slipped out of the room and passed several hours twisting the tune knob on the big radio, until distant voices grew clear, until the music that was being sent out to ride along the wind became distinct and melodic. And he had listened in awe that often approached disbelief as he heard the rumble-throated announcers rattle off strings of call letters. Some he had heard the night before. Others were new from even more distant locations. WLW in Cincinnati, WHO in Iowa, WBAP in Fort Worth, Texas, WWL in New Orleans, WGN and WLS in Chicago, WCKY, WHAS, WNOX, KDKA. There were commercials for stores and restaurants and businesses hundreds of miles away from where he shivered in the darkness, sitting cross-legged on the chilly linoleum in the duplex. News reports about real people in real cities and towns he had never even heard of. Then there would be a strange noise that crept in like some audio tide, something that sounded like he imagined an ocean wave might sound, though he had never actually heard one. It would rise up out of the sea of static to overtake the signals and eventually wash them away. Even the ones that had been the strongest, the most solid, would fall victim to the surge. Sometimes the voices he discovered spoke a language he could not understand, and the music was tinkly, the songs sung in words he didn't know. And then that, too, would fade into the twisting current of static crashes and whines that seemed to rise up and claim what floated to the top of the den for a few precious minutes of lucidity. Jimmy could only imagine the exotic foreign locations of those stations. Have a Tampa Cigar Time is 9:50 with studios in the French Quarter at the Roosevelt Hotel. This is WWL way down yonder in New Orleans. This is the Air Castle of the South, WSM Nashville, Tennessee. Webb Pierce will be stopping by later. It's 57 degrees on Peachtree, and you're listening to WSB in Atlanta. It's the All-Night Truckers Show here on WBAP, with a song going out to John and all the drivers at the MidCon truck stop up there in North Platte, Nebraska tonight. Here's old Hank Williams himself. And now, folks, stay tuned to the Back to the Bible and Jesus Hour here on XERF. But first, have you ever thought about how much money you could make raising baby chickens right there in your own backyard? Most of the stations were only people talking or bits and pieces of dramas that Jimmy happened to drop into the middle of. He felt as if he was eavesdropping on someone else's conversations. But some of the stations were playing the same songs he had come to know from WROG, his local station. And their announcers had the same breakneck spiels, the same joy and excitement that rattled the speakers and slapped a smile on his face. He carefully tweaked the knob to pull those signals through more clearly. He was disappointed as they inevitably faded away. Then later, he located some of them again on the crest of another wave and listened to a few songs before they, once again, plunged beneath the surf noise. He got hooked just like I did, guys.
He did. What touched me about that was I was ill one winter for about 2 weeks, and I was out of school. I don't know if it was the flu or what it was, but my grandmother in the living room, you know, the room that you don't go in unless the preacher comes on Sunday, I was kind of holed up on the sofa there and had a, we had five working fireplaces. So believe you me, I knew how to cut wood. And I was there in a bathrobe, and I slept during the day, and I was up all night. And so for 2 weeks, I listened to an RCA floor model shortwave radio with a green winking eye. And little did I know, my grandmother and I lived in poverty like Jimmy Gill. But that caught me. That was the gotcha for me with Wizard of the Wind, Don. Ted, what got you into radio?
Well, I'll tell you, growing up, listening to radio, I kind of got into it from a strange perspective. I remember my parents took me to a furniture store in Dearborn, of all things. And when I went in, I noticed that there was a microphone on the stage of this furniture store. It used to be, I believe it was a theater, you know. And, of course, that was part of their PA system, I guess, when they had the theater. I don't know what kind of... well, they obviously had to do some sort of live performances, you know, from that stage. But I remember they took me over to the microphone and held me up, and I talked into that microphone, and my voice was going all over the room, and somehow I figured that I was on the radio. Somehow that made sense to me, you know. So for Christmas, I said, I want a microphone. See, because I knew that if I had a microphone, then I'd be on radio. You know, and I was just very, very little. So that was the attraction in. I don't know how that all got started. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it is kind of funny, you know, the way the mind of a kid.
Well, it is.
But
there's something that grabs us.
The thing I think that that grabbed me more than anything was that my dad had given me a Gruno shortwave radio. And later I would, you know, kind of claim it as my own and take it in my room. There's some interesting stories about that old radio. But I remember listening to Radio Moscow. I was listening to HCJB, Quito, Ecuador. Trans World Radio would come on with their ID, you know, from the island of the flamingos. And you'd hear these birds chirping. And then you could tune 40 meters and catch hams operating AM. And oddly enough, my dad had connected this mic up so that when I talked into it, it would come out over the speaker of the shortwave. So I thought for sure those guys could hear me when I would talk into that microphone. It was really kind of crazy, you know. Then I got wound up bedridden for about a year, 2 years. I had a real bad situation as far as a kidney thing going. So I was bedridden, and he brought in a PA system that had a microphone and a speaker. And he was showing me how to play records and talk, and I thought that was going over the radio. So I guess I'd been lied to for my whole childhood, you know.
Well, Ted, I'll tell you, I've worked for some stations that probably had less coverage area and fewer listeners than you did with your PA system.
Well, you know, the thing that I guess I want to say this, I think there's something inside of all of us that are attracted into this. I don't know that it's tangible. You know, I don't know that there's something we can point to and say that's the reason. There may be a number of things that are intangible. But what I was going to say was the fact that the subject that you guys touched on earlier about is shortwave radio dying, okay? I hear these prognostications, and I'm very puzzled by them. The reason why I'm puzzled is I sit behind the microphone of a 100-kilowatt transmitter every Saturday and Sunday, and then on weeknights now between 9 and 11 before Art Bell comes on. And I play music, and I give out an email address, and within the first hour I can get 600, 700 emails in. You can't do that on a Chicago FM. You couldn't do that on a New York City FM. It just, I'm sorry, it wouldn't happen. But it happens on shortwave. And people say, well, who's listening to this? Well, let me just try to paint a little picture here. And that is, and see, Don, what you've done with this book and this thing you just read is you've actually painted a picture of what it was like to slip a transistor radio under your pillow at night when you were a kid so that your parents didn't know that you had it on and how you could spend the night with Records Landecker and a few other fellows that were in different parts of the country. And
John,
and
Records Landecker. Records is truly my middle name.
You'd be caught away by this, you know, and of course you wouldn't. You'd go to sleep with it every night. But anyhow, back years ago, there was a fellow on The Voice of America. Now tell me, Don, if you remember or know this guy. Have you ever listened to the jazz show that was on VOA?
Yes, I remember hearing it.
Okay. That fellow's name was Willis Conover. And the BBC had estimated his audience to be at 30 million. I don't know how they came up with it, but I don't think the BBC would just, you know, make something up that was not founded, especially somebody on VOA, because that was kind of like, you know, their competition, so to speak. So he was on doing the jazz show. There was also another program on at night on VOA that was well listened to called The Breakfast Show. I don't know if you ever heard that, but it was on at some odd time, like 2 a.m. or something, you know. And they played all kinds of music. They mixed in classical pieces with folk, Loretta Lynn, rock and roll, the Stones. I mean, everything. very diversified music. But Willis Conover was rated at having 30 million listeners. And, you know, you think about it, during his time, shortwave radios sat on tables. They all had tubes in them, including the Zenith Transoceanic, you know, that was a portable radio with tubes, but it was big. They were all big. They all sat on the table. Today, for every tube radio that existed back then, I would almost venture to say there's 10 to 20 small handheld shortwave radios that are out there today that are being listened to, and probably far more than that. I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, when you consider the fact that you had to have this box sitting on a table full of glowing tubes in order to pick up shortwave. And at that time, there were 30 million people listening to Willis Conover. It kind of blows your mind when you think about how many thousands upon thousands of small, battery-operated, sensitive, selective shortwave radios are available out there that are being turned on and listened to all over the world. It really kind of dwarfs those numbers. So, I don't know. When I hear about a government shutting down their shortwave, I say, good. That way we get all the people who may have been listening to them, all right? Also, I don't look for governments to do anything that resembles intelligent, okay? Governments don't do intelligent things. They do stupid things. As an example, they tore Bethany down. The Voice of America in Bethany, Ohio. I don't know how much is left in Greenville right now. I know the West Coast version of VOA, it was toppled. Now, you tell me that makes any sense at all. Makes no sense. These people tune in because they love our culture. They love rock and roll music. They like to hear us talk about things. You know, they love country music. They love to hear country music artists on the air. What a better public relations tool for people overseas than to have a very powerful shortwave signal on. And I don't know where it's located, but the Chinese have put a 250,000-watt shortwave station down in South America. It's aimed north to U.S. and Canada. Gosh, what could they be thinking? You know? Anyhow, that's my two cents. Now, I'm just going to warn you, Frank, don't call on me or else you're going to get one of these things here going. But I think Don captured that whole thing just perfectly. I mean, there isn't any way you could make it any better, because I know I was one of those that listened to, and where I was at, I could hear WCFL out of Chicago. And
Now, Don, you have to understand what kind of compliment that is. You couldn't have done that any better, but that was only your second book.
That's right. That was my second book to be published.
And what when you were going through some of the stations, Webb Pierce owned the local daytimer WSNT 1490 in Sandersville, Georgia. A friend of mine, we both grew up out in the country, Ray Smith, he wound up getting the token teenager announcer job that James Wade, he'd always have a teenager there to draw the rock and roll listeners, and Ray got that, and he went into broadcasting. He's now in Savannah and still does some of that. But Webb Pierce was certainly a name I knew, and who could forget Ernie's Record Mart? For 99 cents, you'll get the 45 delivered in the mail. And a lot of those things, as I was chiming in over Ted, John Landecker, Records Honey is truly my middle name. And all those voices are just a magic time. I think to some degree.
And by the way, that's why I dedicated Wizard of the Wind to those 300 wizards who, like I say, could take two turntables and a microphone and put together some magic.
You bet. And that's a great read for anyone who either experienced it or who didn't and who came later but would like to do that. I want to segue just a little bit here to your amateur radio operation. I was glad to hear what you had told us, because I think a lot of hams just don't know your background in commercial broadcasting. But you're an active amateur radio operator and you write on your blog and elsewhere about the different things that, that you've done and built, tell us a little bit about your ham station and your antenna farm and how that's evolved. And I want to know how you then keep that out of your mind when you've got a publishing deadline.
Oh, that's not easy. Because I'm sitting here in front of the computer on which I've written, well, I've written about 45 books. I've only published 30 of them because nobody else wanted to publish the other 15 or so. But just to the left of that is my ham station on the same desk. And I've got a Kenwood TS-590 that I think is a wonderful transceiver, especially for CW, for Morse code. After being a ham for 50 years, I finally added an amplifier. I've got an Ameritron with the three 811 tubes in it, so I can manage about 600 watts on sideband and about 400 watts on CW. But I was always interested in antennas. When I was a kid in high school, my plan before I decided to be a lawyer and then before I decided to be a disc jockey was to be an engineer and to design antenna and transmission systems because I was so fascinated by propagation and by feed line technology and by antennas. I never knew anything about them, but I was fascinated by them. And, of course, in broadcasting, working around various antennas and having to go out and measure field points and helping the engineer do that sort of thing, I got a little bit of an education, just enough to be dangerous in commercial broadcast antenna systems. But it was not until after being inactive for a number of years, you know, family and job and all that sort of thing, when I got back active in 2003, one of the things that I wanted to definitely do is learn more about antennas and transmission systems and transmission lines and antenna tuners and all that sort of thing. Because I think that is one of the big stumbling blocks to most people who get a ham ticket and never manage to get on the air, is they're afraid of putting a station together and having to go out and put up a tower and an antenna. They think they have to do that to be able to enjoy the hobby, and that's not the case. So I've experimented a lot with different antennas. Right now in the backyard, I've got about a 460-foot loop, which is about 100 feet short for 160 meters, but that's where I use it anyway. And I feed it with that old standby ladder line or open wire feed line. I've also got a dipole, big dipole that I feed with open wire feed line. I've got a vertical with about 90 radials under it. It's a trap vertical that works okay in some instances. In a few instances, it's my best antenna. Not very often, but sometimes it is. And I've also got, I built a homebrew hex beam, which is a two-element wire beam that you build using fiberglass and copper wire. It covers the five primary, or my homebrew version did. I had a little problem with it mechanically, and I invested in one of the commercially available hex beams, and that's what I've got up now. And it's a fine little beam. It's a two-element beam, but it certainly outperforms a lot of other antennas that you can use on the various bands. So I'm thinking now about a delta loop maybe for 80 meters. I've got over 100 countries worked and confirmed on every band except 30, 80, and 160. And I'm going to try to work on that total on 30 and 80 this winter when the propagation is a lot better on the lower bands. And I'm looking at the possibility of a delta loop for that.
What kind of RF noise level do you have in your neck of the woods?
Actually, it's not too bad, and that's one of the beauties of the loop, by the way. The vertical is almost unusable at times. I live in your standard suburban neighborhood, so we've got all the plasma TVs and the power lines above ground and all that sort of thing that most people contend with. Our air is polluted, by the way, with RF, legal, illegal, and from all different sources. A lot of the new lighting technology is just filled with noise and polluting the RF frequencies. I can remember sitting in a car in a parking lot in Birmingham, Alabama, listening to WSM in Nashville at noon, loud and clear. I could hear WSB from Atlanta loud and clear here in Birmingham on a car radio with a little whip antenna. Can't do that anymore because all you can hear is noise.
One reason I ask is that, you know, of course, that's a becoming a ubiquitous problem for all urbanites. One of the things that I would suggest to you to think about, because you mentioned the Delta Loop, is a little magnetic loop. You know, there's a Pixel makes one. The one I happen to use is from England, Wellbrook. And Andy Eichen, who's the proprietor there, is very, very nice to work with. The biggest problem is just getting it shipped over here, and they ship it and pack it like a hula hoop. And it is just absolutely great. I think that the Wellbrook magnetic loop and a Perseus SDR is the single best receive combo I've ever had. Now, that's I don't have a tremendous store of equipment, but for dealing with the noise and particularly getting your countries and stuff on 160, part of the problem is being able to hear them. You got a little power, they can probably hear you. But that's a thought. But you've kind of meandered through that, and I've watched your writing about these things, and you describe why you do some of this and that kind of thing very well. Let me compliment you on that. I think it's a great service to fellow hams to tell people why you do what you do, as opposed to, well, I went from A and I went from B. You've also written about that, and we now have a time where we're up over 720,000 hams, and it looks like we're growing 1-2% a year. Being a statistician, I play with some of those numbers. I'm going to launch into a research project. I've got them all the hams from 2000 and each January slice of the SEC database forward. I've got them all geocoded to latitude, longitude, and I'm going to start analyzing those to see where things are growing, hams moving, things like that. But that's in another, that'll be in another venue. The reason I'm bringing this up to you, you've written about how to get on the air and what to do and how to think about it. Tell us a little bit about that book, Get on the Air Now.
Well, and it kind of dovetails with writing the short waves, because it takes it to the next step. One of the things that I've noticed down through the years is people will see my ham radio call plate on the car, or I'll work with somebody, or I'll be speaking to a group on writing somewhere, and I'll mention being a ham radio operator, and someone will come up later. You know, I had a ticket way back when. I got my license, my call letter was such and such, but I never got on the air. Or I got on the air some, and I just kind of lost interest and didn't follow through with it. But someday I think about picking it back up. There are so many people who are either interested in the hobby and drop out before they ever take the exam, or they get a license, they never manage to get on the air, or they fall into what I call the HT trap, the handy-talkie or walkie-talkie trap. They'll get their technician class license, which is great. They'll worry about how they're going to get on the air. So while they're waiting for their call letters to show up in the database from the FCC, they'll go out and buy a $40 Chinese handy talkie. And those are great, by the way. They're almost disposable at $35, $40 a piece. That's a wonderful price. I've got one that I use for my exercise walk every day. I monitor the repeaters or FM broadcasts while I'm walking on that little HT. But guys will get that because it's cheap, it's simple, and they can get on the air. They'll try to work the local repeater, the local 2-meter repeater, for example, and nobody can hear them. They'll maybe hear some harsh language because they keep trying and nobody can hear them, because they've got a little collinear antenna on that thing that is more of a dummy load than it is an antenna, and it's not a real efficient way to try to work 2-meter FM. So they'll throw the thing back in the box and say, you know what, I can talk all over the world on my cell phone, and we've lost them. And we've lost them maybe forever. That's the HT trap. So what I wanted to do first with writing the short waves, and then more explicitly with Get on the Air Now, is to get folks to move beyond that little Chinese HT. Keep it. They're great. Have four or five of them. Move on up to some of the more feature-filled HTs, too, because there are a lot of things you can do with those. But there is so much more to ham radio than a 2-meter repeater with an HT. And that's where I want to move people on to the next step. But I found there are really four. I quantify, as a statistician, you'll appreciate this. I quantify the four big perceived stumbling blocks to getting deeper into the hobby of amateur radio. The very first one is putting a station together. They think it costs too much, it's going to take up too much room, it's too complicated, I won't know how to use that radio. I'll just go buy an HT and that'll be my ham radio for a while. Well, there's the HT trap. The second thing is an antenna. I've got to go outside and put up a 100-foot tower with a six-element beam on it. No, you don't have to do that. And in both books, Riding the Short Waves and then a modified version in Get on the Air Now, I talk about the top five get on the air quick and easy antennas. And there are five of them that you can use, any one of those or a combination, and you can be very successful and get a very satisfying experience out of the hobby. The next thing is, what am I going to talk about? These guys have been doing this for years. They're going to think I'm a nut because I can't, I don't know antenna theory, or I don't know the what it takes to get DXCC, or I don't know what there is to do in the hobby. And then the final thing that sort of ties into number three is the jargon of ham radio. Like anything else that's been around for more than 100 years, the hobby has developed its own language. It's got the technical side and all the electronic terms, of course, but it also has a whole other side of just the jargon that has developed down through the years and continues to develop as we enter into new technology in the hobby. So that's what Get on the Air Now is all about, is getting over those stumbling blocks, real or perceived, to diving deeper into the hobby and getting the full benefit and finding out which aspects of the hobby appeal most to you.
You know, Don, I'm a sociologist also by training and practice, and one of the things that I, in back in the 80s and when computer networks were beginning, I published some papers and things, but one thing I think is very valid was the difference between what I call the social organization of communicating via technology versus the technical organization. And a lot of it, you know, is about what wires to hook up. And while that's confusing enough for the neophyte, it's this sort of social organization side, these choices that you just described to us. Are you going to be a shack and a belt guy? Are you going to do, you know, these kind of things? Even to the things that when my wife first heard me calling someone old man, I got kicked in the shin. That wasn't nice. I had to explain to her that the original old man meant that as a term of endearment. So that social organization side is part of what I hear coming through and Get on the Air Now, and it's woefully, woefully needed.
Yeah, imagine my wife, we were newly married, and I explained to her what an XYL was. That didn't go over very well either.
That is a great book. Let me segue into that. Why do you think we have so many hams today? You know, at a time where my son, you'll appreciate this, being an Alabama grad, my son is assistant golf coach at University of Alabama, and he could care less about amateur radio. He can talk around the world on his cell phone. I have not given him your test yet. He's an avid turkey hunter and deer hunter, and I explained how much cheaper it would be to go down to a fresh market and have them sell him some venison. But given all that, why do you think we've got so many hams today?
I don't think I can put my finger exactly on it, but I think it's the same thing that has created an absolutely booming movement called the Maker Movement, where people want to have hands-on experience with average, everyday sorts of things, whether it's canning peaches or putting up an antenna that will allow you to cast a signal that can be heard on the other side of the world. It's that same thing of where you want to dive in deeper into something that interests you. As I said a few minutes ago, and I wrote an article on this subject, ham radio is not for everybody. But coming from a marketing background, I want to make sure that we expose everyone who might be a potential for getting a lot of enjoyment and satisfaction from the hobby to what is available there. If you think it's just sitting in front of a microphone and talking, you couldn't be farther from the truth. The hobby has so much more to offer, and everyone has multiple interests. Nobody is in a silo. We all have multiple interests, and I don't care what that other interest is or those other interests are, ham radio fits very nicely alongside those interests, and that's what I want people to understand.
On our previous broadcast, Ted and I had the pleasure of interviewing the Young Ham of the Year, Anna Veal. She lives in Littleton, Colorado, with two parents who are also licensed hams. And my closing comment, perhaps a bit long-winded, but I was being very serious. A lot of people complain about the future of this world and look at what young people are doing now and what they should be doing. I go 180 degrees. When we interview people like Anna Veal, I'm very comfortable with tomorrow with young people like that coming on. One of the things that we see happening, some of the surveys I've done for the ARL in the Delta Division, looks at late in life hams. I began listening to that RCA receiver of my grandmother's at age 8, but I only got licensed in 2009. I let the Morse code requirement and just life and chasing grants and having to write and get tenure and promotion and all that kind of stuff that you have to do in any career get between me and a ham ticket. And when I was over in Atlanta at the College Board, I noticed Georgia Tech having a boot camp, and so I got my technician in general fairly quickly and got involved with ARRL. And these surveys show that late-in-life hams are a significant and growing trend. And we don't know why. Maybe somebody had exposure like I did, but never had an Elmer, didn't have the money, had no encouragement, perhaps even discouragement. My grandmother thought I was going to bring lightning down from the heavens and burn the house down with all those wires I had. But that's happening. And so you've got – we always push to get youth involved, but we've got people who are 50 or older who are in their peak earning years. They're typically empty nesters, and they've got time. Time and money allows people to do what they want to do and haven't had the chance, whether it's buying that nice fly rod from Orvis and going to Argentina to fish in the mountains, those streams, or go hunting and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see if this climbs. A lot of them are technicians. We don't have good data on how many are transitioning from technician to general. My case, I've been having so much fun. I just haven't taken my extra exam, but I need to do that. Let's talk about the jargon. I know that's one thing that really is a little bit of a barrier to many hams. Now, I had a great group of hams over in the Atlanta Radio Club that when I was driving a Porsche from Buford downtown Atlanta and a 5-speed and a HT on I-85 in Atlanta, wow. Talk about being a juggler. Arnold Solomon, KC4ZUA, the only person, Don and Ted, that I would contend who can do AM on an FM repeater. Because if you ever heard Arnold, you would know he had his own modulation. He has Arnold modulation. But he was very kind to me when I didn't know how to do a handoff or when I was a little late coming back to the repeater. I really wish we would lighten up a bit and give newcomers a break. I know I got one. You've also written about, Don, you've also written about terms. And you have identified some 1,400 terms. And what I guess, I know of no other one, is the first amateur radio dictionary. You've got 1,400 terms and about 1,600 definitions. Wow. How did you come up with the concept for that book?
Well, first let me say this. You were talking about it's a common criticism of ham radio that everybody's old. Look at all the gray hair at the ham fest or the club meetings. That shouldn't surprise anybody. It's such a wonderful late-in-life hobby. That does not mean that it would not be attractive to young folks, too, if we just let them know what all is out there and they can get into the hobby and find out for themselves. Most all of us who have been around for a long time had that donut in the middle where we weren't very active because of life getting in the way of our hobby, which we should never allow to happen. Now, on jargon, when I was writing Get on the Air Now, one of the things that, as I mentioned, that I felt was a perceived roadblock to people getting deeper into the hobby was the jargon. People are afraid of the language. They flip on the repeater and they hear somebody say they just destinated. They were still copying the machine good, but they were going to, words like that people hear and they say, what are these guys talking about? I'll never pick up all this stuff. So the plan was to put in Get on the Air Now a short list of terms that I felt like would be helpful to newcomers and convince them that what we don't have listed there, they can certainly learn very quickly. And most amateurs are more than happy to explain what the terminology is. But as I started coming up with terms that I thought were important enough to put in there, before I knew it, I had 1,400 of them. So I went ahead and put them in Get on the Air Now, but I decided to publish it separately as the Ham Radio Dictionary. I was surprised as I was looking around to confirm some of the definitions or to give me some ideas of what those terms might be. Even online, I was not able to find a comprehensive and accurate list of ham radio jargon. So I felt like, hey, I might as well go ahead and do one. And as far as I can tell, nobody's ever done the Ham Radio Dictionary, at least nearly as completely as what this one is. So I felt like that would be something good just to keep next to the radio or keep in the car as you drive around mobile, and you can always look up a term very quickly if you need it. Or it's an ebook, so you can search. If you hear a word on the air you don't know what is, you can just search for it on the ebook on the Kindle or the Nook.
You know, Don, now, I was going to say that one of the problems that takes place in amateur radio is is the young ham gets on the air, and with the prospect of misusing a term, then they just, clam up. They don't want to. And especially if they have gotten on the air and they've misused a term, and now all of a sudden they get corrected.
Right.
A lot of the times it's not a gentle correction. It's kind of like a pop on the jaw,
Especially if it came from Citizens Band Radio.
Now, the other thing that I think this is a good thing you've done, that is, I have a lot of fun with this. I have a lot of fun. When I sign out of a QSO or on the radio show as we close out the show, I always say 73s, okay? Very, very adamant about this. And the reason why is I have seen emails come in where the people are just frantic to let me know that the term is 73, not 73s. 73s is improper, okay? So what I do is I let them rant, and then I send them a copy of a QSL card that I've got that W1AW had sent out. On the bottom of the card, it says Maxim Silencer Company, signed by the old man himself, Hiram Percy Maxim. And at the close of the card, he's addressing this now to one person, okay? He says, 73s. And, of course, I come back and say, well, if it's good enough for the old man, it's good enough for me.
Exactly.
And I let him rant, okay? But to have that in writing where a person can thumb through it and you'll hear somebody say something on the air, so almost subliminally, you can come back and use that same term again. But then when you let off on the mic, you're thinking, gee, did I just say something dumb, So that's cool. That's really cool. I applaud you for that, because the people that are coming on to ham radio that are younger, they need something like that. They really need to be able to with assurance say, hey, you know what, I'm using this term in the correct manner, or in an accepted manner, I guess is the best way to put it. But anyway,
yeah, that's what I did with a lot of the terms that may be in disfavor. I actually mentioned in the definition that this is frowned upon or is not typically used this way or whatever. And even a few I say, flat out avoid using this on the air, but you may hear it.
Yeah, I
actually consulted the definitive, Ted, the definitive source for all grammar issues, the podcaster Grammar Girl. I emailed her about this, and she said that if you say 73s, you're correct, but if you want to be in step with others, just make it singular. And she assured me that this was a common problem across many disciplines and that she gets similar questions to that. So I'm with you, Ted. The old man's good enough for me.
Absolutely. Well, you know, actually, there are those who say you should never say 73. If you're using voice communication, you should say best regards, which is silly.
Yes, that's just, gosh, that sounds so formal.
Well, it's like, you call this the QSO radio show. Well, it should be the conversation radio show.
You're not supposed
to use cue signals on voice.
You know, I guess the other thing is that it kind of rattles my cage, though, when I hear, you know, I hear people say things all the time on ham radio that's incorrect. You know, I don't have some compulsion to correct them. I'll let somebody else say something totally incorrect about, you know, an RF situation with an antenna and all that kind of thing, you know. And, you know, I think that if somebody jumps in and tries to correct that person like that, I don't think that's a way that anybody learns. I think all that does is make the person feel, you know, inferior or foolish or something. And I think that also sets them up to really not like you too much either. You know? But I hear that
exactly.
A lot.
You wouldn't do that at a dinner party.
Yeah, you just wouldn't
do it at a dinner party and be invited back. So it's a similar thing.
That goes across multiple disciplines, too. As you fellows know, I also write books on other subjects like World War II history and submarines and that sort of thing. And you should see some of the emails I get. No, the captain would never turn to his left and say those exact words in a attack situation. Who cares? You know, it was factually correct. And I was trying to tell a story about some brave men doing some remarkable things, and yet people are so confused and so concerned about the minute stuff.
Well, the torpedoes and full speed ahead was probably not in the Admiral's manual either.
Probably not, no.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, and that is, you know, are they reading the book because they see, and I see this a lot, one of the problems that we have in this hobby. And I use this term, I call them curmudgeons, okay?
I use that term throughout all these books we've been talking about.
Okay, well, they don't really enjoy the hobby. They're in it for whatever reason they are. They're miserable in their own life, and they love to sit and nitpick and, you know, point out everybody else's faults and what they do wrong and everything. And unfortunately, there's a lot of those presences on the air. And that's one of the biggest, I think, one of the biggest hurdles that we have with young people and new hams, and not just young people, but even somebody that's in their 60s decides, I want to get into ham radio. You know, the last thing they need when they hit the air is a critic. They need supporters, and they need people that are there, you know, at their back and helping them along, not to ream them because they said the wrong thing at the wrong time. And I guess that's kind of what I'm, you know, advocating, you know. So I think that the whole idea of terminology, having a definition of terms, definition of expressions, as well as not just the term and the expression, but the setting in which you could use one of these things or how it's used. And I think that's what you're talking about.
As I mentioned, I talk a lot about curmudgeons because I want newcomers to realize, as in any pursuit, you're going to run into some guys, as you point out, Ted, who are miserable and they sit around waiting for a chance to take a pot shot at somebody. But you know what? If you show up down at the marina, you're going to have some old codger say, you're not going to go out with that lure, are you? You'll never catch anything. I don't care where you are. There are guys who are going to do that sort of thing. Ignore them. Learn from whatever you can and move on.
One of the things that I think we... You know, I'm saying this as a social scientist. If you look at the American Radio Relay League, it's fairly structured down to the state and for the big states, the subsections of the state that are sections. And yet we then have a disconnect between the league and actual clubs. Now, we have this system where you're a certified club or a, well, it's not actually certified, but it's an affiliated club, and you fill out a report. And you have club liaisons that do it in a very perfunctory fashion. You have some who do a great job at promoting clubs. But I think part of the cure to the disease, and what I call it, Ted calls it curmudgeons, John, you call it curmudgeons, I think it's a disease of hardening of the categories. If you don't fit in the categories I learned, then there's something wrong. And that's why I use the phrase, we should lighten up. And I think this dictionary helps because, you know, we're 100 years old now, you know, as a hobby, give or take. And we're going to collect barnacles on the ship. And some of those barnacles are these curmudgeons. In 20 meters, 14.313 is another one.
Oh, boy.
There would be some terms there that you might not want to put in print. But we do have, you know, our rascals and our folks that don't behave. But how do we norm that culture to be welcoming? Well, I think it's clubs, and I think that should be one of the things that clubs should focus on. I'm a member of a club here, and we recently had a new ham who waited a year, and he finally said, one thing I think this club could do better is how it welcomes new hams, because I was welcome and my ham was shook and I drank the coffee and I ate the cookies and I chatted and I talked and I had people help me with, you know, a couple of questions that I ask, but I had to go out and ask them. And this is an ex-military person. The other person who might be a little shyer, you know, they would just drift off and not come back. So I think our clubs are where we do that. I listen to a lot of the hams in the United Kingdom over these web SDR stations. And while I'm editing or writing, I like to have that kind of chatter. And I see a lot of that pro-social interaction in that area. I'm kind of enamored, and in fact I joined RSGB to kind of get more in touch with the culture that they have. You know, you could put it all in Arkansas just about, you'd have the same land space, but I digress. Don, you've added a great deal to what I'd call the ham literature or the stuff that we read, and I think it's hit niches that we truly have needed someone to write in. And so I applaud you for that. I don't know what your other 15 manuscripts are about, but, you know, come back to them. Sometimes every manuscript doesn't have its day today. Its day may be tomorrow. Ted, what's on your mind?
I was going to say pro-social interaction.
Yes.
You know, Don, I'll tell you something. It's amazing when you have a sociologist on the air, the terminology he comes up with. And I jot these things down and ponder them later, and I'm thinking, what is he saying? What's that all about? Anyways.
I'll have to send you a copy of the Dictionary of Sociology. Somebody wrote one of those about 20 years ago. So I'll do. Now what do I mean by that? Are the three of us kind of getting along and supporting each other in what we're talking about?
I would say to some extent, yes.
Yes. And yet no one has sort of picked up the old Saturday Night Live, Jane, you ignorant slut, you know, line of discussion. And that would be the curmudgeon. So the pro-social interaction simply means you embrace the other person's membership in the group. You promote who they are and that they're kind of legitimate, no matter where they come to the table as kind of knowledge base.
So. Kind of legitimate. That's what, you know, yeah, Don,
and
you
my
know,
grandmother called that being nice.
You know, Don, you're going to have to incorporate that into a book somewhere. You're going to have to throw that line in, pro-social interaction. Just make it
pro-social interaction. Yeah. I made a note here.
I think Bob Hiles got a microphone with that name coming out.
Really?
I'm using that headset right now.
You know, I'll tell you, the thing that amazes me, I guess, about amateur radio is the other side of the coin. Yes, we have the curmudgeons out there. And, you know, they're kind of like the squeaky wheels. I mean, they're the one, you notice them because they're the most obnoxious of our group. You know, they really are. They have no social skills. They're socially challenged. They're just poor folks, you know. But there's this other side to this hobby that is, I want to say, most incredible, where we get our term Elmer from, you know. And there are people out there that are so genuine, so sincere, they would do literally anything, absolutely anything, to get a young person started in ham radio. They would do anything to get a more elderly person to be able to pass a test and get a radio and have some companionship in where they're living and whatnot, which is, I think, a tremendous thing. And I think a lot of times we miss those Elmers. We don't see them because they don't publicize what they do. They do what they do because of who they are and what they are. And we just they remain the unseen heroes of ham radio. I don't know if that makes any sense, but Don, I'm sure you've observed this.
Yeah, and I talk about this in the books as well. There is a number, not a huge number, thank goodness, but at least a small number of amateur radio operators who don't want the hobby to grow. They would like for it to stay very small because and make it a very exclusive club. They see the license exam as a hazing process. It should be so difficult that only professional engineers can pass the thing in the first place. You have to build a transmitter from shoestring and tinfoil or draw the schematic diagram of a super heterodyne receiver. They think it should be a very exclusive club. I understand that. But to me, the more new blood we bring in, not only does it justify a huge swatch of radio spectrum that we are granted to use as amateurs, but it also it keeps the hobby vibrant, alive with new ideas and new ways of doing things. But you have to understand, in any pursuit, there are a lot of people who don't want new ways of doing things. They want it to stay status quo. They're not going to encourage folks to come in. But the vast majority of amateur radio operators are welcoming. They're excited about having new folks come in. I love calling CQ. And I can honestly say I may have had some mediocre conversations after calling CQ, but I have never had a bad conversation. And I have had some absolutely many, many fascinating QSOs with guys just out of the blue, striking up a conversation. We're going to talk for 10 minutes, and the next thing I know, 3 hours have gone by. And people start breaking in and tell us how much they enjoyed listening to the conversation. That, to me, is when the hobby really shines.
Have you ever gotten on the air and engaged in a conversation about radio broadcast and old-time broadcast radio? Have you noticed the number of folks that will flock in to that QSO over a period of an hour or two?
Oh, there are a lot of things you could talk about, attract sometimes negative, but usually positive. But you're right. That's a subject area that people will happen upon you, and they'll drop in, and they all want to comment and add to the conversation. And before you know it, you got a big old round table going.
It's weird, though, but is that you get to the end of this discussion, you say, well, I'm going to sign out. It's been good talking, and you've been on the air for 3 hours. It's now 3 o'clock in the morning. And you go to sign out, and when you sign out, there may be 15 or 20 people that will jump in and sign their call sign to let you know they've been listening. That's what is the mind blow. And, you know, I hope you covered this in your book, but this has been kind of a hot button with me, and that is, you know, folks talk about 75 meters, and they say, boy, it's pretty rough on there. Well, you know what it is? Last night I tuned. I was down, I don't know where I was, around maybe 38, 35 or something. There was a group of guys in there, and they were just turning the air about as blue as it could be, you know, and it didn't seem to bother them any. That was just their way of life. But there's so much spectrum that you can get on and call a CQ and just literally sit there until you get an answer, and when you do, things really start to happen. That's when it really turns magical, because now all of a sudden you're connected to someone else. There's conversation going back and forth that others can tune into. And it's so much better than trying to jump into the middle of somebody's round table or somebody's, I don't want to say net, but a group of guys that hang out on a frequency that you don't know, they don't know you. and they probably don't want to know you.
You've got those round tables. The guys have been talking to each other since Eisenhower was president. That's fine if that's what they want to do. They never move the VFO off that frequency. Never. Well, that's great if that's what they want to do. But you're right. You call CQ, you start talking to somebody, you get into an area where you've got some common ground, and before you know it, you got common ground with a bunch of other guys. I think that goes back to something Frank said a long time ago, is how many hams just sit and dial around and listen? Eavesdrop and never even hit the push to talk switch or the key or the keyboard. They just enjoy listening to what other people are saying, and then that conversation will hit a nerve or a point with them, and they'll break in and add to the conversation. That's the beauty of it. That's why I love to hear these roundtables that welcome other people to jump in.
Well, you know, I was last night I tuned into 3916, which is this tailgaters, and I don't know, there's two or three nets that operate on that frequency. Very bunch of friendly guys, you know, but I had it tuned in. And this one guy gets on and he says, well, we're going to start the rag chew session here coming up. And right away, the first thing he said, so if you've never checked in before and this is your first time, be sure to check in. We want to hear from you. And I thought, now that is cool. That is so cool, because it didn't matter at what level of amateur radio that you're into. You could be your first day with a radio listening to HF. You immediately were made to feel at ease and welcome to jump in. And I think the guy even made a comment, something, if you're green and whatever, don't be afraid of jumping in and making a mistake or something like that. And I was really impressed by that. It's 3916. I don't know the... I know I get emails from these guys. They're called the Tailgaters Net or something. I don't know. But there's two or three of them that operate... two or three different groups that operate on that frequency throughout the entire evening. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but I was quite impressed with that.
I've heard of them. I haven't listened in. But, you know, again, that's the beauty of the hobby. I still think 99% of hams are welcoming to other folks. They want to help people enjoy the hobby as much as they have. That's my reason for writing these books. If I was trying to make a fortune on these things, I tell young writers all the time, if you want to get rich and famous writing, forget that. Rob a bank. You'll be rich for a few minutes until they catch you, and then you'll be famous because you'll be on the 7 o'clock news. But 99% of hams are welcoming. They want other folks to come in. They want the more the merrier and that sort of thing. Although the example you're talking about of how people strike up a conversation and it attracts attention from others who are listening sort of reminds me of how the bands can be awful. Propagation is terrible. No signals on the band. Then a contest starts and suddenly signals are pouring in from everywhere. What happened? Does the ionosphere know when a contest starts?
Go ahead, Frank. I hear you in the background there. You're getting ready to say something.
You know, I instead of laughing, I should have said hi.
Yeah, there you go.
Not recommended, you know, according to the Amateur Radio Dictionary.
That's the way it should be. And anytime we say should be, we're putting our own values in the mix. But, you know, those were the initial, you know, kind of the amateur radio code. And I think that one of the best ways of affecting change is how you behave, I guess, is the point I'm getting at. And so what impressed Ted certainly impresses me. And that's, I've had people kind of welcome me into things, and I probably have only had one, what might be a negative interaction. And technically I probably deserved it. But I'm in the boat of helping anyone I can. And the group around here that I affiliate with, that's kind of the culture for that. And if it weren't, I would not attend that group anymore. I'd do something else. But it's a great, great hobby, and it touches everyone. And that's part of the beauty of that. It isn't just the folks that can go to Argentina and fly fish in the, you know, the mountain streams. It takes a nickel or two. This is something anyone can get into.
Don, I want to ask a question, and that is, how many, and I know this is bound to have happened, people have read a book of yours about ham radio and then came back and said, you know, that inspired me. I got my ticket, and I'm on the air now, and it was because I read your book. How many times has this happened? That's question one. Question two is, how did that make you feel?
Well, it has happened quite often. I can't quantify it. I can't tell you exactly. I've got an email folder here where I save those, and that's primarily how they contact me. I'd got my license years ago, and I just never got on the air, but I read your book, and I read that article, or I read that story. Writing the Short Ways, for example, has four or five fictional articles, chapters in there that I use to illustrate what happens. But they'll say, I read that chapter, and it kind of inspired me, and I went out and got a radio, and I'm on the air now. You can imagine how that makes me feel. That's why I write these things. I want to make sure that we expose everybody who is susceptible to the bug, and maybe that bug will take hold and they'll be infected just like you and Frank and I have been for a long time now. I'm confident that will happen. That's why I do it. This is my way. I'm not a big fan of the term Elmer because it doesn't sound modern, but I still, the concept I'm totally sold on. And if this is the way that I can be an Elmer, and if I can help people who have a spark of interest to fan that flame until it just engorges them like it did us, then I've accomplished what I want to do.
You know, we're about out of time, but I want to interject something here. Of the books that you've written, if you wanted to try to spark the interest in a young person or an individual that you're trying to get into the hobby, what book would be good for someone to purchase to give to a prospective ham?
Okay, I would say if you're trying to evangelize to someone who has shown some interest in the hobby but has never moved beyond that, Riding the Short Waves, Exploring the Magic of Amateur Radio will do the trick. That's why I wrote that book. If you've got somebody who's a little farther down the pike, they may have sat for an exam and failed it, or they passed the exam and got the HT, and that's as far as they've gone, Get on the Air Now would be the book. Riding the Short Waves, just I hope it. What I was trying to do is just to show the true magic of the hobby and why it has been around for 100 years and why it's more vibrant than ever now. If people get that message, then I hope that'll make them move on to the point of getting that license, getting on the air, finding the things that interest them in the hobby, and there's so many things that will do that. Then they're going to enjoy the hobby just as much as I have for 55 years.
And I just have one more question, and that is about those books. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but what is the retail price on those books? So if you wanted to buy one for a young person, what's it going to set you back?
Well, it changes hourly on Amazon, but most of the, and you can buy this book anywhere, these books anywhere, in ebook or in regular paper, the old-fashioned version. Riding the Short Waves, Get on the Air Now, those are both right around $17, $18. The Amateur Radio Dictionary is around $15.
Well, see,
I usually sell them a little cheaper than that at Hamfest.
The reason why I'm asking is I want folks to think about this. This is a minimal investment to put into the life of a young person, a book like this that tells a story that could inspire them to only God knows to what level or where they could go once they get into the hobby and ham radio and get that that bug, you know. So you're actually,
and for young people who are tablet and phone oriented, for example, to Get on the Air Now is $8.99 on the Kindle. So it's
right, and the ebooks are about half the price of the paper.
Well, that's, I mean, they're available. These things are available everywhere. They're available on Amazon. And let's give out your website address, Don, so that everybody knows how to find you.
I have two. The ham radio specific web site is www.n4kc.com. My call sign, November 4 Kilo Charlie. And the author website with new information on these books as well as all the other books is simply donkeith.com. donkeith.com.
Well, we are out of time, so I want you to kind of give me anything that you may have wanted to say that you just couldn't figure out where to put it. You could do that right now, so before we go off the air.
All right. Well, look for me on the air. I do PSK 31. I do CW. I do sideband. I work some DX. I love to rag chew. I even have an AM net or an AM schedule that I keep every Tuesday morning with some local area hams on 75 meters around 3885. So look for me on the air. I also try to do as many ham fests as I can. The next one will be in Chattanooga, Tennessee on October 31st. And I'll be doing a presentation on the importance of getting on the air once you get that license at the Chattanooga, Tennessee
campus. And he's very approachable. I've talked to Don at a number of them. And I advertised this tonight as a whodunit. And so in Wizard of the Wind, you're going to have to get the book to find out who done it. It was not the butler.
No.
Well, Frank, any end of radio show kind of remarks or things that you'd like to add to all this, because we've got to pull the plug here.
I was just glad to be part of it. A thoroughly interesting discussion, Don. And Ted, I hope you get the feeling better.
I hope so too, yes. But this has been enjoyable, Don. Thank you much, Frank.
Sorry to say that this is just all the time we've got right now for QSO this week. I want to say a special thanks to our guest, Don Keith, N4KC, along with our co-host Frank Howell, K4FMH. Thank you all for listening. We appreciate you doing that. Join us again next week, same time, same station, or same place. In the meantime, 73s.